Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation.
Maria João Rodrigues is the current president of the Foundation for European Progressive Studies, which aims to research, understand, and find progressive solutions to meet the current challenges facing Europe. She's also a former employment minister for Portugal. This background in policymaking has led her to her work in several important European institutions, such as the European Council and the European Parliament, where she was a member for many years. It has also allowed her to contribute to shape key initiatives within the European Union, such as the Lisbon Strategy, a plan developed in 2000, which aimed to boost and modernize the European Union economy and enhance its competitiveness. Ms. Rodriguez has a PhD in economics from the University of Paris. Mary João, many thanks for agreeing to participate in this podcast. We're very grateful to you for making the time available to talk to us. You have had a very impressive career, which for the past two decades has brought you to the center of European Union policymaking. Please, let's begin this podcast by you telling us a little bit about how you made the transition from public service in your country, in Lisbon, as a government minister in the administration of Prime Minister António Guterres, our current UN Secretary General, to Brussels and the European Council and the European Parliament.
Well, Augusto, first of all, great pleasure to join this Global Governance podcast. I'm a great admirer of all these sequence of talks, and I'm very grateful to have also this opportunity to have a good talk with yourself and with the audience of the Global Governance podcast. Look, I made my way, starting, in fact, with a PhD in economics. And when I made this choice, I was already thinking about putting my energy on policy making with a progressive perspective. And I was given the first opportunity to become a policymaker by António Guterres when he decided to invite me to become his Minister for Employment. This was my starting point of a career, but most of my career was in the European front, because very soon António Guterres, when he was in charge of a presidency of the European Union, he told me, Maria, let's prepare something with a vision and ambition. We have a special responsibility because our presidency will happen exactly in the turn of the century. It was in 2000, precisely. So I start working on the European front by listening to a central leader of the European project, Jacques Delors, who had been for two mandates president of the European Commission. And he told me a very simple, he came with a very simple message. He told me, look, I was able to launch a single market, but when I try to launch a common strategy for growth, competitiveness, and employment, I was dealing with many difficulties. And I give you an advice. Think big, come with the inspiring vision, and go straight to the prime ministers, to the top leaders of the European countries. And this was the approach taken by António Guterres. He was really a very respected leader already by that time. And we use this EU presidency to equip the European Union with its first comprehensive strategy for growth, jobs, and in fact for development. And after that, I went through many, many meetings of the European Council with António Guterres, and I was involved in the inner circle of top decisions, particularly when we understood that with the fall of the Berlin Wall, we should prepare a very ambitious enlargement of the European Union, but we should also combine enlargement with deepening of the European Union. And all this sequence, in fact, happened in the first years of the century because we conducted the largest, the biggest enlargement ever with 10 new countries. But at the same time, we prepare a constitutional treaty for the European Union. So this was the sequence I was involved, and that's why all of a sudden I put myself in the European front, and I've been there until now.
Oh, very interesting, Maria Joel. I remember actually being in Poland and Warsaw in 2004 for the opening or the sort of the inauguration of the expansion, the enlargement of the European Union. It was a very exciting time, I must say. Like you, I have had an intense interest in the evolution of the European Union from 1957, when its six founding members adopted the Treaty of Rome and launched what at that time, in any case, seemed a very ambitious program of, you know, economic integration and political cooperation. What I wanted to ask you is whether you would agree with me that when you look at the history of the Union, it seems to be a long series of, you know, achievements and setbacks, you know, two steps forward, one step back, so to speak, as its members have tried to, you know, grapple, you know, with the challenges of bringing by now 27 nations in sort of to build a new institutional infrastructure of international cooperation. My question related is, if you had to pick two or three moments or important initiatives in recent decades that have strengthened in a significant way this process of integration, what would they be? I'm curious to know, for instance, would COVID and the response to it be one of them?
Indeed. Well, I would say that if we take the long-term perspective, we know that the process of European integration has struggled to identify a good beginning. This was after World War II. And at the start, we had different visions on how to trigger the process. Some actors were focusing more on defense, but very soon, with Jean Monnet, they came to the conclusion that it would be easier to start with the project of a common market, which would create a learning process on how to work together, on how to bridge between countries which have been in a military struggle until then. And the first decades of the European integration were focusing on completing this common market and moving to a full single market, which was then completed with a single currency. So the economic and financial dimension of integration was the predominant one. But I think that in the turn of the century, we start putting the focus also on coordinating these countries with a high ambition regarding economic and social policies in large terms. While we were conducting several waves of enlargement, because we had several waves of enlarging and accepting new countries to join the European project. Nevertheless, with the financial crisis of 2008-2012, we were in the brink of a, I would argue, of an implosion triggered by the Eurozone internal problems. With the financial crisis, the Eurozone has exposed some major failures because, in fact, our economic and monetary union is still not complete. We have a European Central Bank, we have a single currency, but we don't have a powerful common budget or a coordinated taxation policy. And so these failures were exposed, and they turned into a very deep crisis in the Eurozone, which was then transformed into a political crisis. That's why when you now ask me, can you identify some marking important moments of European integration? Well, I will focus on recent ones to make our talk more relevant. And in fact, I will single out the COVID and the European response to the COVID crisis, because I think that a lesson was learned with the Eurozone crisis. We learn that just by pushing for austerity and keeping member states apart, we could, in fact, undermine the entire European Union. So with the pandemics, we took another approach. We start immediately discussing how could we not only coordinate our response to the pandemics, but also to have real internal solidarity. And we have created a stronger budgetary capacity for the first time financed by common issuance of bonds backed by the own resources of the European Union. This is a major financial innovation, in fact, a major political innovation. So this is a turning point, I believe, in the sequence of the European integration. But now, if you ask me about other marking moments, I also like to single out the one I already refer about my talk with Delors and my joint work with Guterres, when in the turn of the century we could equip the European Union with the common strategy for development, for growth and jobs, which was then also used by the countries joining the European Union. So it became a very important glue, common reference for all the countries, quite powerful by that time in the introducing new political priorities in industrial policy, innovation policy, research, social protection, education, and so on. And then I would single out in the political front our attempt to reorganize the European political system with a new treaty, which was the Constitutional Treaty. Then we lost it because negative support in two countries. But somehow I consider that we could rescue most of this Constitutional Treaty with the treaty we now have, which is called the Lisbon Treaty. So that's why I know quite well the story, because I was a member of the team making the financial negotiation. So these are the three moments I will identify. One in economic and social front, another one in the financial front, another one in the political front. I'm not single out something in foreign affairs, because I think the European Union has the potential to become a relevant global actor, but I think we still have a quite important road to go.
Thank you. I remember that I was working as the chief economist of the World Economic Forum in the early years of the new century, and remember distinctively the so-called Lisbon Strategy, which attempted to introduce an element of urgency in European policymaking to enhance the region's competitiveness and boost its productivity and growth prospects. I wanted to ask you, was it the fear of being left behind? I mean, with respect to the United States, the emerging economies of East Asia, which catalyzed this program? And in particular, sort of two decades later, I just wanted to ask you if you could assess briefly its results. I know it's a subject close to your heart, okay, but I think it would be interesting to have an understanding of how you see that strategy, now in the current economic and political environment.
Well, I need to tell you that the starting point for us to define this strategy was, in fact, the so-called competitive challenge. Europe was lagging behind, particularly United States. But we also had in mind also the implications of the Asian emergence, and particularly of the upcoming China. And so our discussion was about a big choice. How should we Europeans strengthen our competitiveness on the long term? Should we go, let's say, the low road, controlling our labor costs, reducing our wages, our social protection system to remain competitive? Or should we rather go to a different kind of competitiveness based on innovation, research, reskilling our labor force in such a way that we could strengthen competitiveness by the high road, meaning based on innovation, education, research, creativity. This was the big choice, and the Lisbon strategy was defined in detail to take this second choice, the second road, by being translated into a detailed agenda in innovation, research policy, employment, education, social protection. The environmental concern was added afterwards. And this kind of attempt to have a comprehensive strategy implemented by all member states of the European Union was then updated 10 years after with the so-called Europe 2020 strategy. And more recently, I would argue that Union is supposed to be committed with sustainable development goals. And our comprehensive development strategy should be really aligned with sustainable development goals. From my viewpoint, the most interesting outcome of this experience was not only about a coordination of policies at European level. It was the fact that this was translated into national programs by member states. It started shaping the national policies. So it became a quite large process of economic and social coordination, which was also taken into account in other arenas. I remember particularly the G20 when it was created after the financial crisis and start defining an agenda, a coordinated agenda of economic and social policies. There was a lot of interest regarding exactly the European experience because somehow it had been a pioneer. I must say that in the first years of the Lisbon Strategy, I was and some of my colleagues were invited a bit all over in the world. We work a lot with Brazil, with South Africa, but most of all with China. And China, in the 5 years plans in this period, got, I believe, some inspiration from the European experience. But so this is the positive, interesting side. But there is a big but, is that for me it is clear, and it became even more clear with the financial crisis in 2008, that we still miss several financial instruments to make sure that all countries in the European Union, they can really implement such a strategy. And I could say the same for sustainable development goals, to make it even more relevant for nowadays discussion. If we ask, do all member states of the European Union have the means to implement all sustainable development goals with an equal chance, I will argue they don't have. Of course, all of them, they need to make their own effort, that's for sure. But we are still in reality with unequal chances, which are created by a single market which sometimes is not properly regulated, and we don't have the kind of European budgetary capacity we should have. We have something very interesting called European Regional Policy, supporting the regions lagging behind, which has played a very positive role for catching up, for upward convergence. This is undeniable, and this is a very interesting experience. Nevertheless, this is not enough to create this upward convergence we need. So we, in fact, we have the risk of several regions in Europe being stuck in real difficulties of a high unemployment and brain drain. They are educated young people, sometimes is leaving because they don't have the life chances they'd like to have. And so these regions are caught in a kind of trap. So we have this problem. And to address it, we need to have stronger financial and budgetary means in the European Union. Our budget, just to recall, is just around 1% of the European GDP. So we are very far from a typical federal budget.
Indeed, indeed. Maria João, the last time we met in Geneva, if you remember, you kindly gave me a copy of your recently released book titled Our European Future, Charting a Progressive Course in the World. And I was actually quite impressed with the book's premise. You put it very early on when you said, and I will quote a couple of sentences from that, humankind is struggling against the global existential challenges. You go on to mention pandemics, climate change, and so on. And then you say there are different ways to respond to today's challenges: paralysis, competition, cooperation, or coordination for upward convergence. And then you said something that I thought was really interesting. You said the European Union can play a role, a key role, in influence which road is taken, but it must start with itself. Elaborate a little bit on that very interesting phrase, start with itself.
No, you are pointing the finger to a crucial issue of European integration. Because, as you know, the European project is a project not only of, let's say, multilateral cooperation among countries, is a project of regional integration. And this means that even, of course, we need to cooperate on many, many issues, we also need to be able to coordinate national policies of all member states according to some common priorities. And more than that, because we really want to go further in integration, so closer integration, we want member states to converge for better standards, what we call upward convergence. And if you want to have upward convergence for better, let's say, job opportunities, education standards, social protection, health access, and so on, but also innovation capacities, we need, first of all, to require the necessary effort from all member states. But we also need to have instruments for European solidarity. And as I was explaining in my previous reply to you, is that our instruments of internal solidarity, they are still too weak. When our budgetary capacity at European level is just 1% of GDP, we are very far from what we can see in states which are real federal states. And that's why the recent COVID experience is really interesting, because the shock was so big that all member states have understood that only way to each of them to save and to respond to the shock was to save the others. Otherwise, we'll go to a downward spiral. And so that's why we accepted to create a stronger instrument for budgetary solidarity. And right now, the discussion we are having, because the pandemic is more under control, is how can we adapt this instrument to respond to the new crisis we are confronted with, which is about the energy crisis stemming from the Ukraine war and the fact that energy prices are increasing so much that the living costs in Europe are really becoming much higher, and we need to have a stronger budgetary capacity to address social inequalities which are now emerging a bit everywhere.
Mary Joel, let me shift gears a little bit and raise with you an issue which has sort of been on my mind off and on for many, many years. My question here is whether the European Union model of international cooperation could be a useful template for the rest of the world. And let me explain why this is a question that is particularly pertinent for me personally. As you know, I come from Latin America, and I have often felt that in Latin America, we have wasted decades, but not taking on board some of the European Union's more progressive and imaginative ideas. We have a long history of talking a lot about integration, but we have a broom closet full of defunct initiatives because we have never built, as you did in Europe, the associated institutional infrastructure to support the process of integration, right? We don't have what you have, a European Parliament, a European Central Bank, a European Court of Justice, and so on. And so the result has been that most Latin American countries, with a couple of exceptions, have been falling behind. You know, if I look at indicators of competitiveness, much of the region is behind Central and Eastern European countries. Those that entered the European Union in 2004, for instance, which for decades, as you know, have been laboring under the burdens of central planning and the Soviet ideology. So, what do you think?
Well, Augusto, I would say this is an extremely interesting question. I must tell you that I myself was involved in discussions in other parts of the world, including Latin America, ASEAN, somehow also African Union, exactly on how far can the European experience of regional integration be interesting and relevant for these other regional entities. And I would argue in the following terms. We know that a successful process of regional integration requires to have cooperation, but more than this, as I was saying before, coordination in different dimensions, in the economic and social dimension, also in the foreign affairs dimension, also extremely relevant, but at the end of the day, in the political dimension. Now, the big question is, what should be the right sequencing regarding these dimensions? And on this, I would argue, we cannot have a single recipe. In Europe, as I was recording at the beginning, there was also a kind of dispute and hesitation on how should we start. Should we start with the market? Should we start with defense? It depends on the historical circumstances. So I remember when I had good talks about this with the Latin American actors, and I also remember to be, for instance, in President Lula's office with his Sherpa for Foreign Affairs. We had a lot of discussions about this, because by that time there were several attempts to strengthen regional integration in Latin America. We are saying, well, it's up to you, Latin American countries, to decide. Of course, we could start with something common. Let's say, let me give an example. All of you, you now have a commitment with implementing sustainable development goals. All of you are supposed to have national plans to implement SDGs. So this could be a common platform to start cooperation and then even more coordination. And then in the end, upward convergence if some countries accept to support the others somehow by building common infrastructures, by exchanging expertise, innovation capacities, investment capacities, and so on. This will be a possible starting point. But again, according to the circumstances, the Latin American countries can conclude it's easier to start with common positions in foreign affairs, in the way to deal with international politics. This can also happen. That's why I'm saying we need to understand that regional integration is more than multilateral cooperation, that's for sure. It goes much deeper. Also because, in fact, in European Union, we have not only multilateral institution, we have a supranational architecture. We have entities such as the European Commission or European Central Bank, which have competencies which are accepted by national governments and institutions. So this is really supranational architecture. So if you have this direction in mind, then look, it depends on the circumstances and it's up to each particular region in the world to see what is the best trigger for regional integration. If you go to ASEAN, well, the ASEAN experience in Southeast Asia has been also quite interesting, but their trigger has been more, I would argue, trade and technological exchanges.
Mary Joao, in 2020, as you will remember, we commemorated the 75th anniversary of the adoption of the UN Charter. And during that year and subsequently, there has been a lot of soul searching about the future of the United Nations. As I indicated before in your own book, Our European Future, you talk about these global existential challenges that we face. And there is a concern in many circles that at a time when we need to strengthen international cooperation to address these global challenges, the UN, perhaps by design, is not quite up to the task. My question to you is, do you share this pessimism? Or might there be a moment in the not-too-distant future when the international community, you know, comes to the realization that we need to rethink our global order in the way that is being done, for instance, in the European Union in recent decades, although it's a regional experiment, but still, it does have this element of building up a supranational infrastructure of institutions, right? So tell us a little bit about your views on the UN.
Well, many thanks also for this question, because I've been also working on the UN experience limits. And look, I don't feel pessimistic about UN. What I feel is critical. I'm critical about the state of affairs with the United Nations system and the multilateral governance as a whole, because for me it's obvious there is a big gap between the kind and size of challenges we are confronted with on one hand and the capacity of our multilateral system as it was designed after World War II is behaving right now. There is a gap between challenges and the capacity to act. So, first of all, we really need to have this more effective system we are calling for, because peace and security is a completely different challenge from the past. We understand that warfare is something much more multidimensional. This is about military, this is about cybersecurity, this is about energy, this is about fundamental resources, this is about migration. So it's really, war and peace are different things today. Secondly, the development is no longer just for developing countries, it's for all countries in the world. This is about implementing sustainable development goals. And the climate challenge is becoming absolutely central, while the digital transformation is changing almost everything in our life. Finally, on human rights, we are now understanding what is really to fight against all forms of discrimination. So I will argue that the nature and the scale of the challenges is completely different. And some of them are perceived as existential challenges by the entire humanity. And this is quite new. And this should leverage a major reform of the United Nations system. But my second concern is with the political architecture, because the system is not really representing humankind. We need to have a much more inclusive system, working with the two dimensions of democracy, representative democracy and participatory democracy. On participatory, well, we have now much more citizens feeling as global citizens and willing to have a voice. On the representative democracy, there are quite huge problems on the way the General Assembly works to be really representative, and particularly on the way the United Nations Security Council is composed, is no longer representative of the international landscape. So these are very serious problems regarding the capacity of the system to be really inclusive. But my final concern is that we need a more effective system, we need a more inclusive system, but we also need a fairer system. Because I believe that we need to go to a major rebalancing in the world regarding access to resources and life chances for all countries and all citizens and all generations. So there is, I would say, a basic unfairness in the current global order. And that's why I believe that we need to have powerful concepts as the ones presented by António Guterres, a new global deal. A new global deal, if this is a real deal, means to have a grand bargain, a real negotiation with give and take in all the main areas. We saw clearly during the pandemics that nobody is safe until everybody is safe. So we need to make sure that developing countries do have access to updated vaccines and better health systems. On the climate, this is obvious. Developing countries, if they are asked to take another role for their industrialization, they should be supported in technological and financial terms. Otherwise, this is not fair enough. And on trade, trade can make a big leverage for growth for everybody, provided the terms of the trade agreements are fair enough. So, and I could go on, give examples. But I really think that, yes, to answer shortly to your questions, the multilateral system is under big pressure, must be updated urgently according, from my viewpoint, to these three priorities: more effective, more inclusive, and fairer.
The focus of the news in the last few months has been what is happening in Ukraine. And I wanted to ask you in particular whether you think that Europe will stand firm in its support for Ukraine as it tries to defend itself against Russian aggression, or do you think that the countries will begin to waver in the face, as you mentioned, rising energy bills and a much weaker economy? It seems to me seems to be at stake for the future of our rules-based order. And I wanted to ask you, since you have been at the center of European policymaking over the last many, many years, what is your sense as to the resilience and the strength of European support for Ukraine?
Well, in fact, I think European Union will be under test. On the way to respond to this aggression of Ukraine coming from Putin's Russia. First of all, I must underline that the immediate reaction of most of European population was a reaction of shock and solidarity with Ukraine, quite spontaneous and natural. This, I think, it was really positive. Because there was the feeling that Ukraine is a democratic nation fighting for its rights and deserves to be supported. And the aggression was obvious. Now, because we understand that this war can be longer, and in fact nobody knows until when, the pressure on many other fronts is increasing, and particularly in energy costs, and then inflation spiral is coming, and even the risk of deflation. which will be extremely worrying and a real challenge for political decisions in all fronts. So, yes, the risk is there that some divisions will emerge inside each country and between countries. I'm pretty sure, as a European policymaker, that we are going through a very difficult year, where, in fact, the European Union will be under test. But I belong to these forces, and there are many in Europe, which understand perfectly that what is at stake here is to support a brave nation like Ukraine, but is much more than this. Is in fact to support the future of the European unity, and much more than this, a rule-based order. Without a rules-based order, everything will be under threat. And so we understand this very well. And we think that at the same time, we are dealing with our internal problems, energy, economic, social. At the same time, we support Ukraine with the weapons and technological and investment capacities. We are also engaged in supporting the multilateral system because we are worried that a major fracture, division, might emerge inside the multilateral system, particularly if we have a full alignment between China and Russia. And so Europe would like to prevent this to happen. Even, I must say, even this morning I was watching the Security Council discussions on how to handle the nuclear plant in Ukraine. And this is really shocking to see how such a risk and a threat for humankind is being played down in such a petty discussion inside the Security Council.
Mary Jo, let me pose a last question. It is a question that sometimes I've asked some of our guests, and I thought that given your career, your experience, it would be a good question to bring this podcast to an end. Among the hundreds of thousands of followers of the Global Governance Forum on social media platforms, we have a large group of young people from all over the world. They are very energized and concerned about the lack of meaningful action to address problems like climate change and others that you mentioned in your book and during this podcast. Can you share with them some words of encouragement so that they take up the initiative and lead the way?
Well, Augusto, many thanks for this question as the last question, because it is really excellent for me to wrap up our conversation today. When I was arguing that we need to have a deep reform of the United Nations system to make it more effective, more inclusive, but also fairer, when I speak about fairness, I'm also speaking about fairness regarding the different generations. I think the world as we have it now is extremely unfair for the upcoming generations. We see this clearly on the climate. We see this around the jobs and education. How come are you having such a high-skilled generation, the higher ever educated generation? And we are not making the best of their capacities and the creativity. So something is deeply wrong. And that's why I really appreciate that Antonio Guterres, in his proposal of our common agenda, is pushing for youngest generation to have a much central role in all our discussions and decisions on the kind of global governance we should build for the future.
listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation. Thank you.